all of those because of the gerrymandering that has happened politically and the barriers that have been put up for access to the ballot box. You've got a political system that is not responsive to the needs of the people. And that is what you saw in Tennessee.
Professor Anderson, I wanted to go to who Justin Jones is, one of the two black legislators who were expelled, was reinstated on Monday. But there still has to be a special election with untold amount of money having to be spent because of the overwhelmingly white legislature expelling them. But Justin Jones, before he was elected in November, was a well-known activist. And one of the things that he did in the last year is one of his targets was the bust of the Confederate Lieutenant General Nathan Bedford Forrest. He wanted it removed from the state capitol. Now, this is very interesting, going to who Nathan Bedford was. The first Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan sold slaves in Memphis, was in command at the Fort Pillow Massacre. Cameron Sexton, the Speaker of the House in Tennessee, voted against the removal. And, of course, each time Justin Jones speaks, he is now calling for him to resign. Talk about the significance of this this push. Ultimately, of course, they did succeed. And guns.
And so part of what you're also seeing here is the kind of, again, valorization of those who were steeped in anti-blackness, those who, and to put that in a public space, saying these are our value systems right here. That speaks volume. It speaks volumes about how intricately woven the anti-blackness is in the operating code, and how you have this has been a consistent push to open up this nation, to, you know, so we hold these truths to be self-evident. The push that you're seeing, what we heard from Justin Jones, what we heard from Justin Pearson, was to make those truths self-evident. And that is to break apart this notion that you've got that you embrace the Confederacy, you embrace the treason of attacking the United States of America, you embrace slaveholding. And so I think about Tate Reeves, the governor of Mississippi, bringing this out as Confederate History Month in Mississippi. The same Mississippi that is removing the control of the police and of the judicial system from Jackson. Again, it's part and parcel of the same pattern, part and parcel of the same drive to put black folks back in their place. I mean, that's what Nathan Bedford Forrest was about. Black folks thought they could be free. Black folks can't be free. Black folks thought that they were equal. Black folks can't be equal. And so when you think about that as the signal, as the public-facing signal, what it says to the rest of the community is a kind of violence, a violence on your own humanity. And this other vision that the Justins are talking about is a vision that recognizes and embraces our humanity, and that finds a way for us to be able to live into that full humanity, not to have this exclusion, this control, because part of what you're seeing in these legislatures is a drive for control, to put all the things back in their place. So black folks need to go back in their place. Women need to go back in their place. Immigrants need to go back in their place. The LGBTQ community needs to go back in their place. That drive to put things back in their place, the push, the counterweight has been no, no. And you heard it when they said no, guilty, guilty, guilty.
Professor Anderson, I want to ask about your new documentary, I Too. I want to play first a clip of the trailer.
Were you taught the Hamburg massacre in school?
No. You look across the river, all you can see is a jungle.
As African Americans, you got to go find it yourself. You got to go research it, because you're going to miss it because they're not telling you.
That's the original cross with the bullet holes.
So you have this church that is providing sanctuary and protection to those who are being chased out of their homes. Now, that is biblical.
When it happened, he hid underneath a streetcar. And see, he could look underneath the car and see people hitting the street.
Here they're sitting in this circle, and they would grab someone, and they'd take them over a hill, and you'd hear a gunshot.
We have no idea how many black people were murdered. Some of these records were intentionally not kept, and some things have oddly enough gone missing.
So that is a clip of the trailer for the new film about you, I, Too. You're talking there about the Hamburg massacre. I'm wondering if you can elaborate on that, and also the attack on African-American history, on American history across this country, where you have Missouri, the House, voting to defund the libraries because if they can't have their books banned, they don't want the libraries open. As in Llano, Texas, they're saying if a judge forces them to put them back, just close the libraries. You recently wrote a piece in the Washington Post titled "Florida's Past Paints Ron DeSantis's War on Wokeism in a Dark Light." Put it all together for us, Professor Anderson.
So as part of this pattern that we're talking about, there's also the attack on history, the attack on knowledge, because of people who knows their history, oh, then they're thinking in very new, vibrant ways. When you know where you come from, when you know the violence that has been rained down on communities, it begins to shatter those very traditional political narratives. So one of the things we did in that film was to link the January 6th insurrection with the coup in Wilmington, North Carolina, where you had a multiracial government in the late 1890s that was overthrown by white supremacists, where you had black folks slaughtered, where you had the newspaper for the black newspaper burned down and trashed, where in Hamburg you had the black militia marching on January 4th down Market Street, and you had two white men come up behind them just angry that black men were in uniform and demanded that they disband, and then demanded that they hand over their guns to them. This is a state militia. And when the black soldiers said no, they were massacred. But when we don't know these histories, then we're able to talk about, we're able to see American as white and male, as patriotism as white and male, as the folks who are fighting for this country as white and male. But what we're really seeing is that you have had black folks believing in America, even when America didn't believe in them. You had black folks fighting for America when America wouldn't fight for them. And you had black folks just pushing this nation to be stronger, to be better, to live up to its ideals. And that is what you saw in Tennessee in the legislature when the Justin stood up and spoke the truth.
And Ron DeSantis, if you can talk about the significance, he's not only, of course, governor of Florida, but is probably running for president.
Yeah, and he's running on that platform of basically anti-blackness, anti-LGBTQ, and anti-woman. So you've got him pushing for the 6-week abortion ban. I believe he signed off on that. You had the scuttling of the African American Studies AP course because it lacked educational value. And you had the attack on Disney because Disney said, you know, LGBTQ folk are folk. And that is a radical idea. And so you see him attacking, because the marginalized, apparently, in his worldview, don't have the power to fight back. And that platform is so racist, homophobic, and disgusting. And it is part of that narrative of trying to bring back control. I think about the old Archie Bunker song, the days when men were men and girls were girls and you knew who you were then. Wouldn't we like to go back to those great old days again? It's hearkening back to a past that wasn't so great because it was violently exclusionary, because it undermined democracy. And so what we're seeing is a full-blown assault on democracy. We're also seeing that full-blown assault on democracy by going after the rule of law, threatening judges, threatening prosecutors who are trying to bring justice to those who have allegedly broken the law. So all of these are factoring in the assault on education, the assault on knowledge, the assault on access to reproductive care, the assault on the right to vote by raising these barriers, and then opening up full-blown access to guns, to the violence that those guns bring, and to craft it in that language of crime, 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 which has that subtone of blackness, blackness, blackness. It's a formula, it's a recipe, and it's an authoritarian recipe. It is an anti-democratic recipe. And it is a recipe that you have young folk pushing back, fighting back. And one of the things that is consistent in American history is that right-wing authoritarianism is always met with a larger, better vision of what America could be. And that is what we're seeing right now, a battle for that vision. There's the Ron DeSantis vision, and then there's the Justin Pearson and Justin Jones vision.
And finally, going back to Justin Pearson and Justin Jones, I couldn't help continually this past week but think of the title of your book, One Person, No Vote. The issue of gerrymandering all over this country, these supermajorities in states where actually the state itself is evenly divided, but because of gerrymandering and what you have in Tennessee, these men, it was not only they who were expelled, it was all the people who voted for them. This wasn't like getting fired from your employment in a store. They were elected.
Right. And oddly enough, or ironically enough, Tennessee was the site of that massive Supreme Court decision that laid out one person, one vote, because of the ways that white rural conservative counties had disproportionate power in the state legislature vis-a-vis Nashville and Memphis. And because of a series of Supreme Court decisions, subsequent Supreme Court decisions, particularly Shelby County v. Holder in 2013, these states have been able to hyper-partisan gerrymander again, and this is the result. So when you have something like 70% or so of Americans wanting to have sensible gun safety legislation, but you have a legislature that is built on extreme partisan gerrymandering, where they appear to be immune from the will of the people, you're not getting that kind of legislative response. And that is why the bullhorn came up, because you had young folk saying to their representatives, we need gun safety legislation. We do not need to be in a space in our workplace where we are being gunned down. And the response from that legislature was they were concerned about their decorum being disrupted because people were responding to the needs of those people, to the needs of those young folk who were out in the halls. So extreme partisan gerrymandering is so anti-democratic, so anti-one person, one vote. And the result is that you've got a society that believes in reproductive rights, a society that believes in the right to vote, a society that believes in gun safety legislation, and you have legislators who aren't responsive to the wants and the needs and the desires of the people.
Well, Carol Anderson, I want to thank you for being with us. We'll continue this discussion. Carol Anderson is professor at Emory University in Atlanta, author of The Second, Race and Guns in a Fatally Unequal America. The paperback edition has just been published. Also author of One Person, No Vote, How Voter Suppression is Destroying Our Democracy, and the book White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. Coming up, President Biden signed legislation ending the coronavirus national emergency, but millions with long COVID say the pandemic is not over. We'll speak with a journalist living with long COVID. Stay with us.
So you think you can tell? Tell a green field from a cold steel rail, a smile from a veil. Do you think you can tell? Did they get you to train your heroes for ghosts, hot ashes for trees, hot air?
Wish You Were Here by Pink Floyd. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. This week, President Biden signed legislation that declared an end to the COVID-19 national emergency. But the pandemic is ongoing for millions living with long COVID. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention found nearly 1 in 5 people infected with COVID-19 go on to experience symptoms of long COVID. One of them is Democratic Senator, former vice presidential candidate Tim Kaine.
I got COVID in March 2020. My case was mild, and by early April 2020, I was fine, except for one lingering symptom. When I first got COVID, I noticed that all of my nerve endings were tingling 24/7. Feels like they've been dipped in an Alka-Seltzer, or like they've all had 5 cups of coffee. I didn't talk about it for a while because I thought I would wake up one day and that symptom would be gone. But that didn't happen. 3 years later, the symptoms haven't gotten worse, but that it also hasn't gotten better. I've since learned that my long COVID symptom is a significantly possible after effect of this viral infection. And while it likely won't get worse, it may never go away. I wish I didn't have long COVID, but having it connects me with people across the country who do.
Virginia Senator Kaine reintroduced the Care for Long COVID Act with Senators Ed Markey and Tammy Duckworth last month. But funding for research and resources remains limited. This is Terry Wilder, chair of the ME Action Minnesota, testifying in March before the Minnesota House Health, Finance and Policy Committee.
It's estimated that 10% to 20% of all Minnesotans who got COVID have experienced long COVID symptoms. This suggests that there are potentially hundreds of thousands of Minnesotans with long COVID who are experiencing significant impacts to their health, functionality, and quality of life. And that includes children, adolescents, and young adults. It's also estimated that around 50% of people with long COVID meet the clinical criteria for the disease I have, myalgic encephalomyelitis. And this is a disabling and complex disease that impacts multiple body systems. It's a neurological disease, according to the World Health Organization. I also want to highlight that COVID-19 has disproportionately impacted Black, Indigenous, and other non-white communities, as well as low-income, rural, disabled, and elder populations.
For more, we're joined in Atlanta by Ryan Pryor, journalist in residence at the Century Foundation, author of The Long Haul. His new article for The Nation magazine is headlined The Long COVID Revolution. His new column for Psychology Today is called Patient Revolution. He's also on the Emmy Action Board of Directors. Welcome to Democracy Now, Ryan. First of all, explain more fully what ME is, how it relates to long COVID. And, I mean, you're not only writing about this, you are living this every day. Talk about your life experience.
Yeah, thanks for having me. ME refers to myalgic encephalomyelitis, as Terry Wilder was talking about in the segment. And myalgic refers to pain. Encephalomyelitis refers to inflammation of the brain and the spinal cord. It also goes by the term chronic fatigue syndrome. So sometimes it's referred to as ME-CFS. So it's a neuroimmune disease that has no approved treatments from the FDA. And many patients become disabled and can't work. I'm fortunate that I'm in the, even though some of the worst experiences of my life made me bedridden, I'm now in the situation where I have a more mild case and I am able to work. But I use my voice as a journalist, as an advocate, and working for a think tank now, working in public policy to pursue ideas and situations and telling the story of millions who can't tell their own stories and who can't live out their dreams. And the primary symptom of ME-CFS and really the primary symptom of long COVID is called post-exertional malaise, which means that people do minor exertions, which could be taking a shower or walking down the block on their street, and that can leave them bedridden or sick for days, if not weeks afterwards. So it makes it impossible to participate in society if you can't do basic functions.
So, Ryan, talk about what it means for President Biden to say that the COVID national emergency is over, what this means for millions of long COVID sufferers. What do you think needs to be done?
Yeah, so for people who've had chronic illnesses for decades prior to the pandemic, many felt that long COVID was a moment where their needs were going to be met. And there's been tremendous power from the chronic illness community that has helped embolden the long COVID movement, this long COVID revolution that we talk about in the piece, that so many groups have come together in this moment of tremendous post-viral illness in ways that they never had before. And so the message that our chronic illness community would have to President Biden and is to acknowledge the fact that there's millions missing, millions of people missing from their lives, and there's millions of dollars are currently still missing from this the research that needs to be done, and really the drug repurposing trials that need to be done to urgently find new treatments to help people with long COVID. As a society, we came together with a public-private partnership for Operation Warp Speed, creating vaccines at the fastest rate and distributing them into our population faster than any vaccine in history. We now have an opportunity to do a similar thing for long COVID, to do an Operation Warp Speed. There's dozens of drugs that could work for ME-CFS and for long COVID, and we need much greater urgency from the National Institutes of Health and from others to get these treatments tested, and many of those probably will work for treating the long disabling symptoms of long COVID. And this is a moment where we can actually learn to characterize and research and treat a number of different diseases, not just long COVID, but long COVID is a way into understanding, like I mentioned before, ME-CFS. Another disease, postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome, POTS, which it means that people's blood heart rates rise rapidly upon standing and people faint. That's another major characteristic of long COVID. So there's so many other chronic illnesses that are post-infection chronic illnesses. And so long COVID represents a time for all of us as a society to understand the number of people who are living with invisible disabilities, these millions missing, who are, you know, homebound or bedbound, and this is their moment to sort of be brought back into the mainstream of medicine.
Ryan Pryor, in your book, your columns, your articles, you draw on the history of HIV/AIDS activists with ACT UP who changed healthcare policy, and disability activists who crawled up the steps of the U.S. Capitol to demand passage of the American Disabilities Act. Talk about this kind of action, what you call a patient revolution.
Yes, and so my colleague Fiona Lowenstein and I wrote a piece for The Nation. Fiona is the author of a book called The Long COVID Survival Guide, and I've also written a book that chronicles the rise of patient groups primarily online. And our piece for The Nation starts with a millions missing protest outside the White House, held one day after the president said on 60 Minutes that the pandemic was over. This was last September. But I think this protest was indicative of a larger history of people with diseases that were not well recognized by the medical establishment who came together to rally for a cure, a rally for treatments. ACT UP and the Treatment Action Group in the 1980s and the 1990s are kind of the hallmark of what health advocacy in the wake of an epidemic or a pandemic looks like. And the same with those who campaigned for the Americans with Disabilities Act that was passed in 1990. So this new generation has stepped up thinking about how to advocate for chronic illnesses. This protest outside the White House was part of this noble tradition of patients speaking on behalf of those that can't speak for themselves. And one note I'll have here is that because people with ME/CFS are so disabled and they experience post-exertional malaise, it's hard to get even a small protest is a major accomplishment in our community, because so much of it has to happen over social media. People are too sick to go out. And but I think that this is the step forward, and bringing more media attention to this protest and really to this larger movement is something that policymakers need to understand. And Senator Kaine's Care for Long COVID Act is one of a number of different solutions. This Operation Warp Speed for long COVID treatments is another idea that I think that these need to be acted on. And patients will be gathering next week for the Long COVID Advocacy Week on Capitol Hill, telling their members of Congress to move these bills forward and to green light really millions, if not billions, of more dollars that could be used to treat this disease. If we don't act quickly to research it and to cure it and to treat it, or to provide disability accommodations or disability benefits for those who are sick, the long-term impact of this of long COVID is of a scale and scope that's hard to understand. Harvard economist David Cutler estimates that there'd be a trillion with a T, impact on the U.S. economy for years to come if we don't address long COVID now. So a major urgent approach to research for long COVID is really important for helping people who unlock their dreams, who might not be able to live the lives that they intended.
Ryan Pryor, I want to thank you so much for coming in to the studio in Atlanta, Georgia, especially given the price you will pay for this, that you yourself are suffering from long COVID, but how important it is to share this information. And we'll continue to cover this much understood, not often talked about issue of long COVID. Ryan Pryor, journalist in residence, Century Foundation, wrote the book, The Long Haul. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
The annual Sled Island Music and Arts Festival is back June 21st to the 25th. Experience 5 days of music, comedy, film, and art in diverse venues across Calgary, Alberta. Featuring genre-defying indie alternative artist Barty Strange as guest curator, garage rock chameleons Osays, Chicago-based indie rock three-piece Dead, Latin folk innovator Helada Negro, Toronto's viral hip-hop sensation Akintoye, gothic folk artist Emma Ruth Rundle, alternative R&B hip-hop artist Amin D, and plus many more. There's 150 artists yet to be announced. Check out the current lineup and get your passes and tickets at sledisland.com.